Hi, this is Karen.
Hey, Karen, it's Suzanne Del Banco calling from Catalyst for Payment Reform. Thanks for picking up.
Nice to hear from you.
I'm calling today because I want to delve into the topic of shared decision making, which I've always been interested in. And I know you're an expert on it, but I wanted to let you know we've got an audience listening, and it would be great if you could introduce yourself to them.
Sure. So as I mentioned, my name's Karen Sapuka. I'm the director of the Health Decision Sciences Center at Massachusetts General Hospital, and I'm also on faculty at Harvard Medical School. And the work that I do is focused on trying to improve the quality of medical decisions. And a big way that we do that is by trying to promote shared decision making.
The phrase I think is pretty self-explanatory, but maybe as an expert, you could tell me what you mean when you say shared decision-making. And I think we're talking about between a healthcare clinician and a patient, but you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that might be helpful is sort of to figure out what it's not. You know, most people are probably familiar with, you know, the doctor knows best, more paternalistic style of decision-making where the doctor makes a recommendation and expects the patient to follow it with little or no input from the patient. And so that's not what we're talking about. There's another alternative approach, which is much more consumeristic that's happening now. Patients Googling things on the internet, finding out what they want to do, or even the doctor saying, you know, here are some options, call me when you know what you want. More like ordering off a menu. But that, again, very little interaction, not what we're talking about for shared decision-making. Really, shared decision-making sits in between those sort of two extremes, and in my opinion, is a great approach for a wide range of medical decisions. And it's really focused on, you know, the physicians and the doctors, the healthcare team, bringing in what we know about the clinical evidence. So this is really grounded in, you know, what do we know about our treatments and tests, the outcomes that might be expected, having that doctor's expertise to apply it to this patient sitting in front of them, then also bringing out and really recognizing the expertise of the patient in terms of their lived experience with the disease, their goals, what matters most to them. And, you know, that shared decision-making is really these conversations to share that information and come up together with the best approach.
And is it something that, like, you know it when you see it, or is there like a checklist that would help one know if shared decision-making had taken place or not? You know what I mean? Is it like, how do we know what it's really happening?
What we found actually is that people don't know it unless they've experienced it. Not everybody's experienced it yet. Mm-hmm. So we do actually have a bit of a checklist. You know, there's a couple of core elements, and then there's a lot more if you want to get into some of the more theory there. But, you know, first off, to have a shared decision, you actually need to have a decision. So you need to have more than one reasonable option. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be multiple options. And in shared decision-making, really, there has to be a discussion of both the pros and the cons. So there's pretty much every option we might be thinking about in medicine, there's going to be some potential benefits and some potential harm. So there needs to be a really robust discussion about that and how likely those are. And then the last piece that's really critical is there needs to be a discussion of patients' preferences. So, you know, options, pros, cons, and preferences, that's kind of the core information that really needs to be shared to have a good shared decision.
That's really helpful. So, you know, you mentioned that not that many people maybe have experienced it, or you said not everyone has experienced it. So how prevalent is shared decision-making between healthcare providers and patients these days?
Good news is we do know it happens. It just doesn't happen all the time or with every doctor. And the data are a little bit limited in terms of thinking about, you know, what's happening across the US. But the data we do have comes from two different sources. There's sort of a macro level source that we've used a lot, which has derived out of the work that Jack Runberg and colleagues at the Dartmouth Atlas have done, when they looked at documenting the use of healthcare across the country. And they really documented huge variation in rates of tests and procedures. And the troubling implication there from that data is that the care a patient receives depends more on their zip code, like where they live and what doctor they happen to see, rather than on who they are and what they care about.
Yeah.
So that's problematic, you know, raising some questions. And then the second source, there's research studies that have actually either audio taped visits and tried to track to see whether these behaviors have happened, or surveyed patients. And there are a couple of national studies that have looked at this using the same kind of questions across different kinds of common decisions like cancer screening, medication decisions, surgical decisions. And they find, you know, some areas, there's actually pretty good evidence that shared decision-making is happening, like PSA testing for prostate cancer screening often has some pretty good conversations. People say they hear about, you know, no testing as an option, that the doctors are asking them about what they want to do. Same with back surgery. We actually find some of the highest scores in back surgery, but then there's other areas with really little or no evidence, certain cardiac procedures and other cancer screening tests.
Is there a regular attempt to measure whether this is happening? Like, is it part of Joint Commission accreditation or, you know, National Committee on Quality Assurance, NCQA surveys, or, you know, is there any standardized effort to gauge its prevalence?
So I'm not aware of any like national or standardized efforts or even any public reporting of this kind of data. And I think that's an area that would be really important to pursue. I mean, it would be pretty exciting to have hospitals or clinician groups compete on how well they're informing and engaging their patients. Yeah. There are some questions. There's a supplemental set of questions that's part of the CAHPS patient experience surveys that focus on shared decision-making. And, you know, I know locally, for example, at our health system at Mass General Brigham, we've been working with orthopedics for several years now, and they actually have incorporated shared decision-making questions into their patient-reported outcomes registry. Mm-hmm. So they've been tracking it for every patient who's undergone hip and knee replacement surgery, spine surgery, using some NQF-endorsed measures. So we've been gaining a lot of insights into how do these scores vary across procedures, across surgeons, across sites, but it's more used as a tool for quality improvement as opposed to something that's more publicly
Right. And is there any correlation with either outcomes or, you know, if you will, patient satisfaction, you know, like sort of looking back and saying, yeah, I made the right choice?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are, you know, certainly lots of reasons to do this and lots of benefits from shared decision-making. You know, we've seen that when you really do engage and inform patients that they do get treatments that are sort of more aligned with their goals. So I think there's a sort of benefits on that side. And then we have shown that folks who engage in shared decision-making actually do have better outcomes in certain areas. So not all areas, but in certain areas. And we did find that in orthopedics, actually, that they had better overall and disease-specific quality of life scores if the decisions that they made were, you know, well-informed and reflected what the patient wanted.
That's really fascinating. And I think there's probably lots of reasons for that, which I don't know if we have time to get into today, but between, you know, sort of bolstering, like making yourself feel good about the decision that you made, or because you got to make the decision, you feel sort of more agency and you're better at follow up with your physical therapy and things like that. Or I don't know, I guess there could be a lot of explanations. Any that really strike you as, you know, the reasons you think that there's a correlation with outcomes?
So I think, you know, one of the things we've, you know, we do see is that there, you know, so they have less conflict. So like there's this construct called decisional conflict. So if you engage patients in shared decision-making, there's less decisional conflict. So they are more committed to the decision, which I think you were getting at a bit.
Yeah.
There haven't been a ton of studies that have looked at adherence. There's a few that I think do show that that does translate into people being able to more effectively follow through, especially for things where it's not a one-shot kind of deal, where maybe they need rehab or they need to follow up or take a medication, you know, over time. So that that there is that sense, and that they're also able to handle little blips that come up because they were better, you know, they have more realistic expectations. They don't just stop when something doesn't go wrong because it's like, oh, I knew this was going to happen. So I know I have to keep going and I'll just get through this piece.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Are doctors paid for the time that they spend in doing shared decision-making with their patients? Or is it something that they're just expected to do with however they're regularly paid for their visits and procedures and tests that they do?
So that's a great question. You know, there's certainly like we've done a lot of work to try and implement shared decision making. And one of the things we hear as a barrier is, gosh, I just don't have enough time to do this. And I think that's a reflection of sort of where do we place the value in our healthcare system? Is it on, you know, these conversations? I think there's another concern that we hear that's a little bit different, but it's that, you know, for example, for specialty providers or surgeons, you know, we know that actually, if you start to really engage patients and help them understand the potential benefits, the potential harms, and the non-surgical options, that they're often less likely to choose the invasive treatment. So that has a kind of direct impact on their income in the way most of our, you know, fee-for-service system has been set up. So there's sort of some very explicit financial disincentives for some folks to do this. So I think that is a challenge. And I think there's, you know, whether we pay doctors directly to do this, I think there've been some different approaches.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting because, you know, one, I don't know if this is really a perfect analogy, but we did write up a case study on a spinal surgery center of excellence program that Walmart put together. And in that, they decided very consciously to have a separate payment for evaluating the patient before the bundled payment, you know, for the mm-hmm. procedure even began because they wanted to reduce the incentive for the provider to say, you know, oh yeah, I think I'm just going to do the surgery, but to look to see whether the patient would really benefit from it. And whether it was due to the expertise of their centers of excellence or to the separate payment or some combination of thereof, you know, they were able to see a 50% reduction in the number of people that went forward with the surgery, which it's not about withholding care. It's about only doing that more risky intervention if it's going to benefit the patient. So again, we can't attribute that solely to the payment model. It does raise a question about whether payment models are allowing for shared decision making today, and could alternative ones make it easier for providers to do it.
Yeah, you know, so I think there's a couple of examples. For example, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has started a couple areas putting shared decision making into their payment policies for new tests and treatments. Mm-hmm. So like lung cancer screening for the CT scans, CMS requires documentation of a shared decision making conversation and the use of a decision aid in order to pay for the CT scan.
Yeah.
They have similar requirements for, you know, two areas in cardiology, implantable cardio defibrillators, as well as for folks with heart failure, LVADs, left ventricular assist devices.
Yep.
You know, so they're really promoting the use of shared decision-making and decision aids. That said, I'm not aware of any audits or have they refused payment, sort of setting up this mechanism to say, you guys have to be thinking about shared decision-making when we're introducing these devices to patients. And I think that's pretty interesting. The other area that I think they've done something really interesting is for the aortic valve replacement. So when there's a transcatheter valve, which is kind of this new approach, minimally invasive, and it's sort of disrupting that area, which typically you would have a surgical, you know, valve replacement, which is obviously open heart surgery, a major, major procedure. And the payment policy for the TAVR requires that patients have to see both the interventional cardiologist who typically did the TAVR as well as a cardiac surgeon who typically does the surgical approach. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, they're trying to get the patients to hear from both perspectives.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's a really interesting idea of sort of, you know, paying for this multidisciplinary care so people can really get a full picture of what their options are. And I think that's potentially a great model to think about for promoting shared decision-making.
Yeah. I mean, it seems obvious, probably quite obvious to you and obvious to me, that shared decision making is just the right thing to do. And you've certainly outlined some very tangible benefits that could arise, you know, if it were more prevalent. Do you have hope that it will become more prevalent?
I do. I mean, so I've been doing this for about 20 years. And, you know, when I started, we had to knock on doors and, you know, try to get people to say, yes, this is important. And now we have people knocking on our door saying, how do I do it? Like, I want to do it. I just don't know how to do it. So that it shifted from why do I have to do this to just how do we actually do this in a busy practice? Where do we get the, you know, resources? Are there good patient decision aids or other, you know, tools that we can use that we know have evidence that can help, and how can we put this into practice? So that's what we're hearing more now. So I'm very optimistic about where we're going to go.
Well, that is exciting and refreshing to hear. And I think, you know, it goes along with lots of other efforts that are out there to put more information in the hands of patients and help them interpret it and navigate their healthcare journey in some way that's more supported. So that can only be a good thing. I really appreciate you taking the time to tell me about all this. And I hope, you know, to hear what comes out of those CMS studies and, or I shouldn't say studies, programs, and, you know, what the results are. And I would love to stay in touch, just, you know, if you have more insights for us and the guidance we try to provide to employers and other big healthcare purchasers, mm-hmm. I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, that'd be great. You know, I mean, I think I'm really interested to understand also how do these, I often work at the level of the individual patient and the individual physician, but realize that they're operating in this system and this environment that's sort of constraining or, you know, trying to give them opportunities and resources to do things differently. So, you know, the idea that we could innovate on how do we incentivize physicians to do this? How do we actually incentivize patients? You know, I think often this is actually asking patients to do more than they might be expecting.
Yeah.
So can we make it worth their while to review a decision aid in advance of a visit? You know, will they get a waiving a copay if they do that? I think there's some, you know, pretty interesting models that we could think about. And I'm excited to see what happens.
Yeah, no, that's a great point that, you know, the benefit design can play a piece in it as well. And, you know, I know that shared decision-making can take place in conversation, or as you mentioned, these decision aids, you know, there's all kinds of cool whether it's just a video or something more complicated, like a decision tree on that's put into an app, you know, that a patient finds their way through. You know, there's so many ways to deliver this information. It seems like in this day and age, we should be able to come up with ways to make it more feasible. So
definitely. And I think it's also, you know, I mean, we're also moving towards more team-based care. So I think we also can expand this past just a single doctor and single patient. They're right. getting the rest of the healthcare team involved right. can really make a difference and make some of these things, you know, much easier to really implement as part of routine care.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for your time. Yeah. I so appreciate it. And I hope you have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thanks.